A comprehensive and thoughtful contribution to the ongoing debate is the 2008 study published by the Commission on Growth and Development, chaired by Nobel Economics Laureate Michael Spence. The 21 commissioners who prepared it brought together a rich variety of perspectives, drawn from decades of experience in government, academia, and the business world, both in developed and developing countries. The report benefited from consultation with leading experts on a broad array of issues, including the roles of fiscal policy, education, geography, trade, technology, institutions, and interactions with the environment, among others. The Commission examined the experience of 13 countries, which, beginning in 1960, grew at an average rate of at least 7% over a period of 25 years or more, and identified those factors, common or country-specific, that contributed to such remarkable economic performance. An economy that grows at an average annual rate of 7% doubles in size roughly every 10 years. The 13 economies examined are Botswana, Brazil, China, Hong Kong, Indonesia, Japan, the Republic of Korea, Malaysia, Malta, Oman, Singapore, Taiwan, and Thailand. During the periods of high growth, these economies, broadly, exhibit some common features, including full exploitation of the opportunities afforded by the world economy through trade, foreign investment, and inward technology transfer, macroeconomic stability, and high rates of saving. On the whole, their reasonably competent governments were able to avoid some of the terrible mistakes which have been so costly in other countries, such as subsidizing energy consumption, using the civil service as employer of last resort, neglecting infrastructure, imposing price controls, and underestimating the importance of education as the key driver of the development process. The Commission is unambiguous in the benefits it attaches to economic growth. Let me just quote briefly a couple of paragraphs from the report. Growth is not an end in itself, they said, but it makes it possible to achieve other important objectives of individuals and societies. It can spare people en masse from poverty and drudgery. Nothing else ever has. It also creates the resources to support healthcare, education, and the other Millennium Development Goals to which the world has committed itself. In short, we take the view that growth is a necessary, if not sufficient, condition for broader development, enlarging the scope for individuals to be productive and creative, unquote. Then, further on in the report, they go on to say, I again quote, in a very poor country, it is arithmetically impossible to reduce poverty without growth. There is no one to redistribute from. Conversely, if everyone is poor, growth will reduce poverty regardless of how it is distributed. But some kinds of growth reduce poverty more effectively than others. The expansion of smallholder farming, for example, cuts poverty quickly. Raising incomes of rural cultivators and reducing the price of the poor's food bill. Growth in labor-intensive manufacturing also raises the incomes of the poor. The expansion of capital-intensive mining industries, on the other hand, can result in jobless growth, making little impression on poverty. Professor Spence was even more direct when the report was released, saying in a press conference that, and I quote, the growth report also kills off, once and for all, the misguided notion that you can lift people out of poverty in the absence of growth, unquote. He also noted that India needed to grow at a fast pace of around another 13 to 15 years to catch up where China is today, and that it was expected that some 600 million people in China presently working in agriculture would need to move into more productive jobs in urban areas, and that therefore, as had happened in the past 20 years in China, growth will lift many more people out of poverty in the coming decades. notwithstanding the unanimous consensus among the Growth Commission report's distinguished authors, their views are by no means universally shared, particularly among scientists and experts laboring on environmental issues. A writer for the magazine The New Scientist, for instance, put it this way, perhaps somewhat sarcastically, quote, "Growth, to most economists, is as essential as the air we breathe. It is, they claim, the only force capable of lifting the poor out of poverty, feeding the world's growing population, meeting the costs of rising public spending and stimulating technological development, not to mention funding increasingly expensive lifestyles. They see no limits to growth ever," unquote. The essence of the arguments put forward by environmentalists is that our economy is now reaching the point where it is outstripping Earth's ability to sustain it. Resources are running out and waste sinks are becoming full. The remaining natural world can no longer support the existing economy, much less one that continues to expand, as was put by Herman Daly some years ago. Two leading academics, distinguished professors at MIT, Stanley Fischer and Rüdiger Dornbusch, in a book on macroeconomics written some 15 years ago, explained their view by saying the following. I quote, "Production uses up natural resources, in particular energy. It is true, as is sometimes alleged, that exponential growth in the economy will eventually use up the fixed stock of resources." They ask, "Well, yes," they say, "it is true in the limited sense that current theories suggest the universe will one day run down. However, this seems more of a concern for a course in astrophysics or perhaps theology than for a course in economics. Over any interesting horizon, they say, the economy is protected from resource depletion disasters by two factors. First, technological progress permits us to produce more using fewer resources. For instance, the energy efficiency of room lighting has increased by a factor of 4,500 since Neolithic times. Second, as specific resources come into short supply, their prices rise, leading producers to shift towards substitutes. This conventional economic view must be contrasted with the clear scientific evidence that we have already reached, if not overshot, planetary boundaries, and are eroding the natural capital that is treated by these economists as a fixed or as a free resource, on which all life depends for survival. The conventional logic notwithstanding, there is also the economic impact of the sustained rise in energy prices. As fossil fuel extraction becomes more expensive and comparable, rises in prices for food and raw materials, as well as the rising cost of natural disasters linked to climate change. It is increasingly costly just to maintain our present level of development. Global resource limits are already producing shortages that now require some rethinking about the basic assumptions that have justified our focus on growth in recent decades. As the head of the European Central Bank put it in 2009, in the middle of a very large financial crisis, he said, and I quote, "We live in a non-linear times. The classic economic models and theories cannot be applied, and future developments cannot be foreseen," unquote. In this context, it is understandable that efforts are underway to explore prosperity without growth, or the implications of a steady-state economy.